Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. As promised, the author of the New Testament is here with us this hour, and that would be Jimmy Akin. Jimmy Akin is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of many things, including a brand new book, 20 Answers, the New Testament, for us here at Catholic Answers. Hello, Jimmy.
Howdy. How's it going, Cy Kellett?
It's going very well. How does it feel to have written the New Testament?
Well, I didn't write the New Testament.
It says the New Testament right
there. It says 20 answers, the New Testament.
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying.
You have to take into account the superscription.
Oh, okay. All right. But this seems like the one that you were born to write, as far as 20 answers books.
Sure. Why not?
Yeah. Okay. All right. Fair enough. What did you try to do?
Answer 20 questions about the New Testament. That was the primary goal I was after.
And okay. So as you answer those 20 questions, I imagine really, as far as the New Testament goes, there's got to be 1,011 questions at least that you could have done.
At least.
So you, when I say, what did you try to do? You must have, you had some focusing kind of
I wanted to answer the basic questions that people have about the New Testament. So this starts out, you know, the very first question, what is the New Testament? And it goes from there. I talk about the individual books that are part of the New Testament. I talk about how they were written. I talk about how we can study them, how we can learn more from them. And I talk about different ways they've been interpreted, the principles that you use to interpret them, all kinds of stuff like that.
If you'd like to talk with Jimmy about the New Testament, 888-318-7884 is our number. If you got a question about a particular book or about I guess we could call it the library that we call the New Testament. Would that be a fair way to say it?
Yes, absolutely.
It's a library of books.
Yeah, it's a library because they didn't have the ability in the first century to put all of the books of the New Testament in a single volume. So they wouldn't have thought of the New Testament as a book. They would have thought of it as a collection of books or a library of books.
Again, 888-318-7884, the number 888-31-TRUTH, if you prefer the spelled version. Who wrote the most books in the New Testament?
St. Paul.
All right. So this is striking in a certain way in that at least before his death and resurrection, it doesn't seem like St. Paul met Jesus, or is it possible that he did meet Jesus?
It doesn't seem to have been the case. If he certainly wasn't a Christian prior to Jesus' death and resurrection. And if he had met Jesus even as an unbeliever or even seen him, it probably would have been mentioned somewhere because that would have been a noteworthy fact relevant to his life and early hostility to the church. And you would expect somewhere he would say something like, not just I persecuted the church or I was blind before I became a Christian, but I was so blind I met Jesus and didn't even believe him at the time.
Yeah, right. That would be right. That certainly seems to be something Paul would mention. Okay, so he ends up writing the most books. But how did that happen? How did we get all the Paul stuff, all the Pauline stuff? Books.
Well, he, you know, was a traveling evangelist, and so he founded and visited churches in many different places. And then, as a pastor, he needed to provide pastoral care for people in these churches. And since at the time you couldn't fly to these churches, you know, air travel didn't exist, and so travel was very time consuming and dangerous. And also, since you couldn't just Skype in and give him pastoral counsel, he carried on correspondence with the different churches. And so that was his primary motivating theme in all of his letters, was dealing with mostly people he had met, but some of the letters were also written to people he hadn't met, which is kind of interesting.
Is that Romans?
Romans is one of those. It also looks like Ephesians is one of those. There's a kind of a mystery about Ephesians because he knew the Church of Ephesus very well. He'd been there a bunch of times. He spent 3 years there once. Yeah. And so he knew the Ephesians very well. But you read the letter to the Ephesians, and it's like he's writing to people he doesn't know. These people don't know him. This doesn't read like his other letters. And there are no personal—one of the aspects of that, not the only one, but one of them is there are no personal greetings.
okay.
in Ephesians. He's always saying hello to people and so-and-so greets you and stuff. None of that in Ephesians. And so as a result of that, scholars have proposed that Ephesians may be a circular letter. That is, a letter that was designed to be sent to multiple different churches, like an encyclical.
Oh, and he's counting on them to do it.
Or someone. He sent Ephesians with a man named Tychicus. He also sent two other letters at the same time, Colossians and Philemon. And one of the things he mentions in, and he also had not visited Colossae before. But one of the things he mentions in Colossians is he says, be sure and get the letter to the Laodiceans and read it and let them read this letter.
Right.
And Laodicea was a church that was very close to Colossae. And it doesn't seem Paul had been to either one, but it seems he was writing to churches in this area at this time, which is why he knew the Laodiceans would be nearby. They would have this other letter. And it's interesting, in some early manuscripts of Ephesians, the words, so he like greets the saints who are in Ephesus and are faithful to Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
But in some early manuscripts, the words in Ephesus are not there.
Oh, so and, that may have,
yeah,
that might be a later.
And so it's just like to the saints who are faithful in Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And some people have even suggested that Ephesians, or a copy of it, went to Laodicea. And so it's actually the lost letter to the Laodiceans. In fact, there seem to have been people as early as the second century who said that, because there was a heretic named Marcion who, in his version of the New Testament, he didn't have Ephesians, but he did have something called Laodiceans and in its place. And so it looks like maybe copies of this letter went to several churches. One of them may have been Ephesus, which is why in Ephesus got written in.
Yeah.
But another may have gone to Laodicea, which is where Marcion got Laodiceans. And then others may have gone elsewhere.
Just from the description of how Paul wrote, you get a sense that of the New Testament being addressed to a community that's pretty kind of bustling, like it's all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
It's geographically diverse. And
Now you, as a radio host, don't get to talk until I hit you on the shoulder. Okay, I'll hit you on the shoulder.
I do the stuff you tell me to do, Jimmy, and that was going to be the most boringest radio program ever. Okay, so is that true of the Gospels as well? Are they kind of written to a community, or how the Gospels?
Well, so we have a little bit of information about this.
Mm-hmm.
I should mention a theory that was very common for a long time in, like, especially in the 19th and 20th centuries, that the Gospels were basically written for a community, but for a very specific one. So, like, Matthew wrote for one church, and John wrote for one church, and so forth. And you'll find a lot of 20th century scholarship talking about Matthew was serving the needs of his church, and they try to view everything through the lens of, why did Matthew say it this way? How did that? What does that tell us about the church he was writing to?
Right.
Well, okay, so not so much.
Okay.
If you're going to go to the effort to write a gospel, you probably don't want it read in just one church. You probably want it read lots of places.
Right.
And so more recent scholarship has indicated that, no, the gospels are not written to just single churches. They were written to be read more broadly in multiple churches all over the place. Now, that didn't mean they didn't have a local origin. The information we have about Mark's gospel suggests that Mark's gospel was written at Rome at the request of Romans, because Peter had come there preaching, and he was, you know, ministered in Rome off and on over a period of about 25 years. And the Romans wanted a written record of Peter's preaching. And according to a first century source, that's what Mark is. It's
mm-hmm.
it's a written version of the anecdotes that Peter would preach. So that one did seem to have kind of a local origin. Another gospel that also seems to have been written in Rome is Luke. Luke addresses A man, both the Gospel of Luke and the Book of Acts are addressed to a man named Theophilus, or at least he's called Theophilus. The word means lover of God.
So
it could, some people have said maybe that's a code name to keep the guy's identity safe.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, Luke dedicates both books to Theophilus. And in the second book, Acts, it ends in this really strange way. Paul has been building up to the trial of Luke has been building up to the trial of St. Paul under Nero for just chapters and chapters and chapters.
Yeah.
Depending on how you count it, he's devoted like seven chapters, that's a quarter of the book, to how does Paul get to Rome for his trial.
Right.
And it just cuts off with no resolution.
Mm-hmm.
And that suggests, well, it cuts off because the trial hadn't happened yet. That's when Acts was written. And Paul, at the end of Acts, he's in Rome for a two-year period under house arrest, preaching the word of God freely to everybody who comes to him. And since that's where and when Acts cuts off, that suggests that's where and when Acts was written. And thus, that's where and when Luke's gospel was also written. And so it looks like Luke's gospel also was likely written in Rome. But you got this Theophilus guy. Why is he involved? Well, some people have suggested that maybe he was like a Roman official and these were briefing documents to help get him up to speed for Paul's trial. But they're not written that way.
No.
If they were written that way, they would have, you know, discussions of, okay, these are the charges and this is why they don't hold water and stuff like that. They're not written like courtroom briefing documents. Instead, it seems like Theophilus wasn't a Christian. And so why would Luke write a gospel and dedicate his gospel and Acts to a particular Christian? Most plausible theory in my mind is because Theophilus was Luke's literary patron.
Yeah.
Theophilus was the one footing the bill
for this.
For this.
Right.
And that probably meant publishing the book with multiple copies. So at the time, books were incredibly expensive. Only rich people could afford them. And so so probably Theophilus was a rich Roman Christian who was underwriting an upgraded edition of Mark that in the form of Luke, that he would then not only pay Luke's expenses in writing it, but also pay for multiple copies to be made and then distributed to various churches. We don't know how many copies there might have been. I kind of use 10 as a rough estimation point. We know the Book of Revelation seems to have had, when it was published, it seems to have had around 8 copies made. One for St. John and one for each of the seven churches he wrote to.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Right. If you address it to the seven churches.
Then, yeah.
Okay. So just before we take our break, I imagine that the earliest copies of any part of the New Testament are probably just fragmentary. We probably don't have early full texts. Mm-hmm. So how far back, like a piece of paper that actually has a gospel or a letter of Paul on it,
About the year 125.
Oh, my gosh.
Is one of the earliest. It's called the Rylands Papyrus. It's a fragment of the Gospel of John. It's over in a museum in England. Recently, there was a claim that a fragment of Mark had been found in Egypt that dated to the first century. And we all had to wait for years for that to be published. It finally was published either last year or early this year. And it turned out that subsequent dating suggests it's probably second century. So the earliest one we still...
But still, that's very close.
Yeah.
Which would suggest, if I may, it seemed like that would suggest that there were a lot of copies of these things.
Yeah.
Because to have anything survive that long, you got to have a lot of opportunities for something to survive that
long. Yeah, and typically it had to find its way to Egypt because that's where it's dry and the writing material won't rot over 2,000 years necessarily.
Jimmy Akin's brand new 20 Answers book is The New Testament. We're discussing The New Testament with Jimmy. If you've got a question, 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. And The New Testament, like pretty much everything else, I think you can find on sale at shop.catholic.com, because right now we're having the summertime read, listen, and watch sale. We've got dozens of great books, CDs, DVDs for $15, $10, $5, and as low as $1. The way it works is you just visit shop.catholic.com and you click on the $1, $5, $10, or $15 banner, and you'll find books, CDs, and DVDs for the selected price right there for you. Go over to shop.catholic.com and get your summer read, listen, and watch deals right now.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Prayer has been so powerful in my communication with God, understanding the church better, most importantly, understanding the Lord better, and myself better. I heard it said once that God answers Knee-mail, as in K-N-E-E. Prayer is powerful. One of the favorite things I love to do when it comes to prayer is to ask for the intercession of the great saints. Try it sometime. You'll be very, very impressed and surprised by the amazing power of prayer.
We're talking about the New Testament with the author of a brand new book, 20 Answers, the New Testament from Catholic Answers. Jimmy Akin, of course, is our guest. And let's get to your questions. Adam in Fort Wayne, Indiana, listening on Redeemer Radio. You are up first today with Jimmy Akin. Your question, please. Hi, Adam.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Happy to.
I had a question about the epistle from James.
Okay.
I've looked into who the true author is, and there seems to be a little bit of a discrepancy, mm-hmm. and it's one that kind of holds significance to me, so I just wanted to call and get your take on the author.
Okay. So the author of the book of James simply identifies himself as James. He doesn't give us the name of his father or any other relatives, which is unfortunate for our purposes because that's how people normally identified themselves. And the fact he doesn't give any familial relationship data suggests he was the most prominent James at the time. And the most prominent James at the time, the only one who could get away with just saying James, a servant of Jesus Christ, would be James the Just, the so-called brother of the Lord. Now, why do I say that? Well, the other Jameses aren't good candidates for that. There are a bunch of people in the Bible in the New Testament named James. It was a very common name. During Jesus's ministry, James, the son of Zebedee, was more famous. He was one of the 12 apostles, and in fact, he was one of the core 12 apostles. Whenever you look at the lists of the apostles in the New Testament, the list is given a number of times. And whenever you look at it, it's always divided. In each case, it's divided into a set of three blocks of four names. Peter's always at the top. Judas is always at the bottom, except in Acts where he's dead. And you always find the same four names in each block. The top block is always Peter as the first name, and then in some order, Andrew, Peter's brother, and James and John, the sons of Zebedee. Sometimes Andrew is higher, sometimes James and John are higher. The fact that James is named first whenever he's mentioned with John also suggests he was the older brother. But here's the thing. He was the first apostle to be martyred. That's mentioned at the beginning of Acts chapter 12. He was put to death around AD 43, in fact, Passover of AD 43, by King Herod Agrippa I, who was a grandson of Herod the Great. And as a result of that, he wasn't around in the age when the New Testament books were being written. This was before any of the New Testament books were written. So he was off the scene by that point. Now, there was another James who was one of the 12. He's called James the Short or James the Little, or in some older translations, James the Less. Sometimes you'll also see him called James the Younger. Really, short and less are just other way, and younger are all different ways of translating the same word in Greek. Apparently, he was either shorter or younger than James, the son of Zebedee. The less doesn't indicate that he was less of an apostle than James, son of Zebedee. Although he actually was kind of less of an apostle. I mean, he was lower ranking in any event. When you look at the list of the 12 apostles, James the Short is always down there in the third block. So he was not a prominent apostle. Now, in the history of biblical interpretation, some folks have said, well, he's the brother of the Lord. That's who that is. It's James the Less is the brother of the Lord. But there are some problems with that. If James the Less were the brother of the Lord, then he shouldn't be in that bottom block. He was if he and James the Just are the same guy, mm-hmm. then James the Just was an incredibly prominent leader in later years in church history. He became a bishop of Jerusalem, and he ought to be. He also got his own personal resurrection appearance, according to 1 Corinthians 15. And so he shouldn't be in that bottom block. He also shouldn't have a seemingly diminishing title like the Short or the Younger.
Yeah.
You know, because those being short and young were not good things back then. Mm-hmm. And but then there's a more fundamental reason why I don't think it's James the Just and James the Younger, James the Short are the same guy. And that is James the Short was a follower of Jesus during his ministry. But John, now, and this is indicated in other gospels, like in it's in Mark, for example, it's in actually all four gospels, to where James, Jesus's brethren are not believers during his ministry. But John makes it explicit. John just comes out and says Jesus's brothers did not believe in him. Mm-hmm. Now, they later came to after the resurrection. Presumably, James, the brother of the Lord, got enlightened when the resurrected Jesus appeared to him.
Yeah.
That kind of turned him around. Yeah. but because John says, and the other gospels imply, that Jesus's brothers were not his followers, they certainly, during the ministry, they certainly couldn't have been among the 12 apostles who were following him around during his ministry. So I would say James the Less or James the Short is a different guy. He's not the brother of the Lord. And the one that we have in Acts after James, son of Zebedee, dies, the one who is called the brother of the Lord, also known as James the Just, is the one who wrote the letter. He was the most prominent James in later years. And so he was the one who could get away with just saying James, a servant of the Lord. People have wondered why doesn't he meant say James, the brother of Jesus? Because other people called him that. Well, you have that passage in the Synoptic Gospels where his brothers like come to try to get Jesus to lay off the ministry.
Yeah.
And Jesus emphasizes that it's not, being his blood relative is not what's important. It's being his spiritual relative. So if James, the brother of the Lord, were saying, ha ha, I'm the brother of Jesus, that could be seen as throwing his weight around in a way that would clash with Jesus's own teachings.
Yes.
So the fact he had a family relationship with Jesus, actually it would have been legal rather than blood, but the fact he had a family relationship with Jesus is probably de-emphasized in this precisely because of Jesus's own teachings.
Okay, Adam.
Yes, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very, very much. We're talking about the New Testament with Jimmy Akin. If you have a question about the New Testament, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884. Anybody's welcome to call with any question at all about the New Testament, 888-318-7884. Up next is Al in Marcellus, New York, watching on YouTube Live. Al, your question for Jimmy.
Yes, my question is taken from Matthew's Gospel, the tail end of chapter 8.
Okay.
And it's with regards to the story regarding the Gadarene demoniac.
Uh-huh.
And I just wanted to know, and this is a question that I always have thought about for a long time. Mm-hmm. Why did the inhabitants ask Jesus to leave after he drove out the demons?
Well,
I mean, I don't know if there's a definitive answer or not.
Oh, I think we have a pretty good idea on this one. The reason is, there's a couple of them, but basically you look at people's reaction whenever an angel or supernaturally potent being shows up, and the first thing they say is, don't be afraid. Because powerful supernatural stuff is scary. Peter tells Jesus, go away, Lord, I'm a sinful man.
Yeah.
And Jesus had also just allowed the demons to go into the pigs and destroyed a whole herd of pigs. So that's kind of seeming dangerous a little bit.
Right back with more New Testament.
We're here for you. Give us a call today on Catholic Answers Live.
Jesus asked his disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" Turns out that today, as back then, this question has a lot of different answers. So many groups want to appropriate Jesus, tweaking his identity until he looks and sounds just like one of them. But then you no longer have the Lord, says apologist Trent Horn. You have an imposter. In his new groundbreaking book, Counterfeit Christ, Trent exposes 18 phony versions of Jesus that we encounter today, helping you to recognize the fakes when you see them, explain why they're phony, and make a case for the full truth and beauty of who Jesus is, the Christ, the Son of the living God. Order your copy of Counterfeit Christ today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Love and beauty. As a little girl, Dawn Eden Goldstein knew that she wanted those things, that in them somehow she would find God. Over the years as a rock journalist, she moved among some of popular music's best-known artists, straining to capture that transcendent love and beauty in every note and lyric. In Sunday Will Never Be the Same, Dawn recounts her spiritual journey in beautifully wrought detail, mixing powerful accounts of trauma, healing, and epiphany with funny anecdotes from inside the music scene. It is the rare conversion story that delights as it inspires, amuses as it edifies, and ultimately lays before the reader a lived testimony to the transforming grace of Christ. Order your copy of Sunday Will Never Be the Same by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Tomorrow on More to Life, Father's Day.
Let's celebrate the great dad in your life.
Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Jimmy Akin is our guest this hour. Jimmy, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and author of many things, but today we're focusing on his 20 Answers book.
In fact, I'm about to turn in a new book manuscript probably tonight.
Are you really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so because you turn it in by hitting the send button.
Yes.
And off it goes.
Yeah.
And that one is Catholic
Bible. The Bible is a Catholic book.
Bible is a Catholic
book. So it covers the Old Testament and the New Testament.
And that is a quick turnaround
from
that they're going to make. Because that book comes out in September.
That's right, yeah.
All right, well, I hope you didn't make any mistakes.
Did you have any doubt?
Okay, Jimmy, I have no lack of confidence on Jimmy's part. That's why you want to get
this book. That's a deliberately ambiguous statement.
Okay, all right.
It's like a non-denial denial.
I didn't have any doubt, though, that you did. Well, anyways, 20 Answers to the New Testament is the newest book published, anyways, by Jimmy Akin. And we're talking about the New Testament this hour. Tom in Omaha, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio, is up next. Tom, you got a question for Jimmy Akin?
Yes, I did.
All right.
I was just wondering about the book of Hebrews.
Mm-hmm.
It does not list itself as having an author, mm-hmm. and it seems like some of what it says relates to Paul, but mm-hmm. the style is sure different. So I just wondering who your thoughts were on who might have authored it.
Well, I don't know for sure. The early church didn't know. So whoever the author was, the certain knowledge of that got lost pretty early on, because already in the second and early third centuries, you have people confessing they don't know who it is. The book was associated with St. Paul, and for a lot of centuries, people assumed it was St. Paul. I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One of them is the thought is kind of like St. Paul's thought. The author takes a similar approach to the way Paul interprets things and various Jewish institutions. It certainly sounds like it's coming more from someone on the Pauline end of the spectrum than, say, the Jacobian or Jamesian end of the spectrum of Jewish Christianity. Also, though, it mentions Timothy. And it right at the end, it says, by the way, Timothy's out of jail. He hopes to come visit you soon.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Timothy was Paul's right-hand man as a traveling companion. And so the fact it mentions Timothy, I think, led people to think, oh, well, it must be Paul, since Timothy was Paul's right-hand man. But there are other things in it that don't sound like Paul. One of the things is he talks about how we've received the faith from, you know, the apostles and stuff, and that doesn't sound like Paul. He's Mr. Hey, I'm an apostle, okay?
Yeah, right. He's always
He's not going to talk. I got a personal revelation from Jesus Christ.
Yes,
he appeared to me.
Yeah.
And so he's all about how he got the faith from Jesus directly. And he's very defensive about the fact he's an apostle. If you want to see him just melt down mm-hmm. over this issue, read the last three chapters of 2 Corinthians, because it's fascinating. You know, you're reading 2 Corinthians, and he's apparently written them. He had originally planned to visit them, but he decided not to because he was going to have to take him to task. And so he sent them a letter where he took him to task in letter. This is kind of like sending someone a difficult email instead of going and having a difficult conversation, because it lowers the emotional temperature. And he wrote him a letter that he says he wrote with tears. And this is often called, by scholars, it's called the severe letter
mm-hmm.
Or the sorrowful letter. And he sent it off. He didn't know how they were going to respond. He was anxious about, were they going to shape up or not. And then he gets a messenger, says, oh, yeah, they still love you, and they've repented and all this stuff. And so he's writing 2 Corinthians, and it's going, yay, yay, yay. So we're all happy now. And then in chapter 10, the tone flips. It's like Paul flips out. Apparently, someone had come to him and said that, oh, some people have arrived in Corinth or are in Corinth challenging your authority as an apostle.
Oh.
And he just melts down over this issue. So fact that the author of Hebrews is attributing his and others' knowledge of the faith to a prior generation of Christians suggests this isn't St. Paul. But you read it, and it does sound like it's a Jewish person. Because he says God spoke to our fathers in many ways by the prophets. So mm-hmm. that suggests a Jew rather than a Gentile, because Gentile fathers didn't get spoken to by the prophets. And he seems to be someone who's in Italy or writing to Italy, because at the end of the work there are there are greetings from those from Italy. And so he does seem to have contact with Italy. He also does view himself as a teacher. So all of those things give us little clues, but we really don't know. One suggestion that was made early on was, and this was from Tertullian, is that it was Barnabas, also a traveling companion of Paul, who thus could have had a similar viewpoint on things. Origen says that he's aware of two traditions, at least two, regarding its authorship. One tradition he was aware of said that it was Luke. And I've seen some scholars argue that the Greek of Hebrews is like Luke's Greek style.
Oh, okay.
But Origen was also aware of a tradition that it was written by Pope St. Clement I, the author of First Clement.
Okay.
But he doesn't ultimately know. And what he concludes is, who wrote it? God knows.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, so, we're going to have to leave it there.
I would say probably a Jew who was in Paul's circles, but was, and I think the fact it seems to be a Jewish person rules Luke out.
Yeah.
Because he seems to be a Gentile. I would say it seems to be a Jewish person in Paul's circle who's not Timothy.
Tom, hope that was helpful to you. Thank you very much for the call. We're talking about the New Testament with Jimmy Akin today. Questions on the New Testament are welcome. We go now to Jeff in Heartland, Michigan, listening on 990 AM Michigan Catholic Radio. Jeff, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Happy to.
Jimmy, I come from a family that is split. We have Catholics on one side and Lutherans on the other.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm well aware why late Protestants wanted to eliminate those seven books in the Old Testament, Baruch, Tobit, Wisdom, Sirach, Judith, 1st and 2nd Maccabees.
Uh-huh.
But I wanted to know, I also heard that Martin Luther was not the biggest fan. Obviously, I know why he's not a fan of the Book of James, but I also heard Revelation was something that he wanted to get rid of. Is that true?
Yeah, it is. Revelation was one of four books in the New Testament that Luther did, whose canonicity Luther at least questioned. The others were Hebrews, James, for obvious reasons, and Jude. And he said that his criteria for canonicity was, did it preach the gospel as Luther understood it? And in his view, these four books didn't preach the gospel as he understood it. And so he at least questioned their canonicity. At times, he said things that would even suggest he may have denied their canonicity. And he put them all at the end of his German New Testament with prefaces that indicated they were not among the true and certain books of Scripture. So he's kind of a little ambiguous there. But yes, it is true. Revelation was one of the books he questioned.
Tom, we'll leave it there because there are lots of folks who want to talk about the New Testament today with Jimmy Akin. And excuse me, that was Jeff. I apologize, Jeff. We go now to Mark in Spokane, Washington. Mark, do we have you with us?
Hi, I got to pull over, get off the road here, and talk to you.
You got to pull over to be able to ask your question to Jimmy? You know what? That's very, very safe. Let's just say that.
That's very safe. Maybe we take another call so he can safely pull off and doesn't have to rush.
Well, that's a good point. All right, we'll get right back to you, Mark. Let us go then. Let me see who's up next. Up next is another Mark in Northern New Jersey listening on Mark of New Jersey listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. You are on the air, Mark of New Jersey. You have a question for Jimmy?
Yeah. Hi, Jimmy. Hi, Cy. How you doing?
Good. Thank you, Mark.
Okay. My question has to do mainly with Matthew chapter 18.
Okay.
Specifically verses 17 through 20. I know that section connects back up with Matthew 16, where Peter's given the keys and he's given the authority to bind and loose. I'm going to be meeting with some Protestant friends this weekend, and we have a friendly debate going. And, you know, I'm going to bring up about sola scriptura and, of course, church authority. Mm-hmm. And I myself am a Catholic revert. You know, I was, you know, born and raised a Catholic. I left the church for a number of years, spent a lot of time with our separated brethren, particularly the Baptists.
Mm-hmm. How can
so
I help
I'm
you, Mark?
Anticipating, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. It has to do with for where two or more, where two or three are gathered in my name. There I am among them. My friends are probably going to claim that that's universal. That's for any believer, any Christian believer. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering if the claim can be made that the binding and loosing can be made for just average lay people, or if that just applies to priests.
Yeah.
And bishops.
So one of the difficulties we have is this passage occurs in one of Matthew's five discourses. The Gospel of Matthew, in addition to the narrative story of Jesus from, his birth through the resurrection, Matthew has five major discourses that are on different topics. The first of these is the Sermon on the Mount, which is Jesus' ethical discourse, where he talks about what morality requires. The next is called the missionary discourse, and he talks about how the apostles are to go on mission and proclaim the gospel and what's going to happen and stuff. The third one is the kingdom parables, including the parable of the sower, and these are all about the kingdom of God, and they're all in parable form. Then in Matthew chapter 18, we have what's sometimes called the church discipline discourse. And finally, in Matthew 24 to 25, you have the Olivet discourse, which is Jesus's prophetic discourse. And in these discourses, Matthew gathers up things Jesus said on different occasions. You can show that because if you look at the parallels in Mark and Luke,
yes,
he'll say things there that are scattered all over the place, and Matthew's put them together in these topical orderings. There's even a topical ordering of the five discourses. It's arranged in what's called a chiasmus or chiasm, which is kind of like a pyramid. So the first and last elements mirror each other, giving us Jesus's understanding of law and prophecy, the law and the prophets being the two components of the Old Testament. You move one step in from that, you have what the church is to do externally, evangelize, and what it's to do internally, discipline. And then at the center of it all, you have the mystery of God's kingdom. And so there's even an order to how these things are, to how the discourses are arranged. Well, within each discourse, you can't assume that Jesus just uttered all of these things on the same occasion. That's not what Matthew's doing. He's stitching together things said on this general topic on different occasions. And that means when Jesus says, when two or three are gathered in my name, I'm there, you can't insist that, we have to read the next saying as if it's just an extension of this. And so you need to look at more than just that. And given that the power of binding and loosing is something obviously everyone in the church isn't meant to have, because if it was, you would have people. You have to understand what binding and loosing means, first of all. Binding and loosing, it's unfamiliar language to us today, but it was language that was used in the first century, and it referred to, among other things, the ability to make authoritative rules of conduct for the community. The Jewish historian Josephus, for example, talks about how during a certain reign of a particular queen in Israel, the Pharisees had the power to bind and loose. And so that's what this meant. Well, obviously, everyone in the community cannot make law for the Christian community. So you have to, in light of the known meaning of this phrase, interpret it in that light. And it implies, by its nature, this statement applies to leaders and not to just everybody. If you want backup for what I just said about the meaning of the phrase binding and loosing, go online, look up the Jewish Encyclopedia. It's online for free, and they have an article on binding and loosing that covers the data I just mentioned, as well as more about that phrase.
Thanks, Mark. We got to take a break, so I'll leave it there and hope that that was helpful to you. We're talking about the New Testament with Jimmy Akin today. And don't forget right now, Catholic Answers Magazine is on sale. You get $10 off a one-year subscription, $20 off a two-year subscription, and $5 off the all-digital subscription. It makes a wonderful Father's Day gift, or a gift to anybody, family, friends, maybe to your parish, maybe your pastor or a seminarian, you know. You just go to CatholicAnswersMagazine.com and you get your savings, $10 off a one-year subscription, $20 off a two-year subscription, and $5 off the all-digital subscription at CatholicAnswersMagazine.com.
We're waiting for your call. Grab that line and get on board.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
I've got a few things here and there that I've learned along the way. I'm always studying history, and I love studying history. So I try to bring in some of the historical perspective, especially at a time in our history when people don't know much history anymore.
Open Line with Father Mitch Pacwa, tonight, 10 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin has a brand new booklet here from Catholic Answers, 20 Answers, the New Testament. It's one of the latest in the New Testament series. And so we're talking about the New Testament today with the aforementioned Jimmy Akin. You're welcome to call with your question on the New Testament. 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-318-7884. We go now to Mark in Spokane, Washington. Mark, we're going to see if you got to pull over there and find a safe spot. Are you there with us, Mark? All right, your question for Jimmy.
She brought up another one.
Well,
it is in John, when Christ says that he's the banner from heaven, and the people started questioning, how could he do this?
Mm-hmm.
I believe somebody said, don't we know his father? Mm-hmm. Well, Joseph disappeared when... in the Bible, when Christ was like 12, that's the last we heard of him. Does that indicate that he was alive then?
So what happens in this passage is, this is John 6:42 for people who want to look it up. And depending on the translation you read, it's going to say something like, is this not Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know? I would have to do some checking in Greek, which I don't have in front of me, to examine a couple of possibilities. One is, when they say whose father and mother we know, they've already mentioned Joseph. And so the nearest reference for whose in Greek, for the pronoun equivalent to whose, may be Joseph, not Jesus. So I would want to look at the Greek. I'd want to look at what some commentators have said. If that's the meaning, if they're saying, well, isn't this Jesus, the son of Joseph, and we know who Joseph's father and mother were, then that all they're saying is that they know who Joseph is, not that he's still alive. On the other hand, that may not be what's indicated in the text here. In that case, I'd want to zoom in particular on the verb to know in Greek and see what tense it is, because, and how it's being used in context. Because to just say you know who someone's father and mother is doesn't mean they're alive. You could say, I know Jimmy Akin's father and mother, meaning I know who they are,
mm-hmm.
but mine are both dead. And so so that could be the case here. On the other hand, it could be taken as evidence that Joseph was still alive. However, I don't think that's going to carry the day because we have all of these other relatives of Jesus appearing on camera in the Gospels and Acts, his mom, his so-called brothers and sisters. They all, you know, they're moving around doing stuff. They appear in the story, but not Joseph. As Mark of Washington says, when Jesus is 12 is the last time Joseph appears on camera, yeah, so to speak. And so given that, also, it would make no sense if Joseph were still alive at the time of the crucifixion for Jesus to entrust Mary, his mother, to the beloved disciple. She would naturally be entrusted back to her own husband.
Yeah,
and so that wouldn't make any sense. And if Joseph had died during the course of Jesus's ministry, we would expect a mention of that fact. So that suggests the balance of probability, taking all the evidence into account, is that Joseph died sometime between when Jesus was 12 and when he was 30 and began the ministry.
Mark, thank you very, very much for that. Appreciate that. Next up is Rob in Mansfield, Massachusetts, listening on 1060 AM. Rob, do we have you with us?
Hi.
Hi, Rob. Your question for Jimmy.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Happy to.
Here is my question. And it's coming from the point of view of a very believing, devout Catholic, me. Mm-hmm. But Jesus wanted us to believe in him. He wanted us to believe that he is the way to the Father, that he is our Savior. And as I understand it, one of the things he did to help us believe was perform some miracles, some signs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We all know them. Okay. What I wonder, I've long wondered, why did he not perform a stupendous miracle? I mean, literally move a mountain.
Yeah.
Or literally, no kidding, make a grove of titanium trees that would sit there in Galilee that could be seen 1,000 and 2,000 and 10,000 years later that would be impossible for anyone not to believe.
I vote for the titanium trees if it was going to be one or the other. Certainly, it seems like Jesus could have, so why not?
So there are a number of reasons why not. Jesus does want people to believe in him if they're willing to do the Father's will. And he gives anyone who's willing to do the Father's will the assurance that they'll, if you're willing to do God's will, you will find out whether Jesus' teaching is divine or not. He gives that promise in John's gospel. So he does use miracles to help people in that regard, but he also has some limitations. He wants people who are willing to do God's will. Actually, if from a certain point of view, it could be detrimental to people if they're not willing to do God's will, and you make it even clearer, because then they have no excuse. So there's some added spiritual risk there. It's like St. Peter says, it's better not to have known the way than to know it and turn your back on it.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Jesus was planning on being crucified, and that meant that some people needed to oppose him. So he wasn't out to convince everybody. That seems to be part of why he used parables to keep the authorities from coming to a full understanding of who he was, because then they wouldn't have crucified him, and that was his part of his mission. On the other hand, I would say Jesus did do stupendous miracles. I mean, feeding of the 5,000,
yeah,
walking on water, rising from the dead, all of those were stupendous miracles. And we even today can have enough evidence that he rose from the dead that people can and do write books about it, just reviewing the evidence for Jesus's resurrection from the dead. So that is an enduring miracle of a stupendous nature that people can examine the evidence for today. In terms of other particular miracles, well, of a massive nature and enduring nature, well, if he moved a mountain today, 2,000 years later, skeptics would look at that and say, yeah, there's a legend that some prophet moved this mountain, but it must have just been some geological force that did it. And if he had made a forest of titanium trees, they would have said, ancient art project. Maybe some maybe some ancient civilization had metalworking skills we don't know about, or even, I'm not saying it was aliens, but it was aliens.
That's the History Channel,
yeah,
I'm gathering.
Yeah. So people who are skeptical and want to disbelieve something will disbelieve it. And that's part of why Jesus isn't interested in just continually upping the level of signs he's performing. I mean, he had people saying, oh, well, if you're the Son of God, perform us a sign. He had that at the last minute. They've got him blindfolded. They're hitting him on the head and saying, prophecy, who hit you?
Yeah.
Well, he's not interested in playing that game. He gives us enough evidence to come to him. He assures us if we're willing to do God's will, we will get the evidence we need. But he doesn't promise us any particular form or amount of evidence, even though we might want it.
Rob, we will leave it there because we have come to the end. Thank you very, very much for that question. The book we've been talking about, well, we've been talking about the New Testament, but Jimmy wrote a 20 answers book with 20 questions and 20 answers about the New Testament. You can get that at shop.catholic.com, where there's a sale going on, so you might want to check that out as well over at shop.catholic.com. Jimmy Akin, thank you very much for another fine hour.
My pleasure, Cy Kelly.
I hope we'll see you again soon in here.
Yeah, maybe tomorrow.
Okay, that's good. Let's do open forum and we'll have Jimmy Akin come in and answer any question. I just thought of this, Nick. Any question people have at all about the Catholic faith, they can call in tomorrow and Jimmy will answer it. How's that? That sound okay? All right. We'll see you then, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.